Testing. Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 5:37 p.m. on Wednesday, May 1st, 2024. Present today, we've got Representative Hannon, Representative Josephson, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cologne, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. We do have five bills. However, we will not get to them all. We will go till 7 o'clock and then we'll adjourn and we'll figure out how to proceed with the bills that are remaining. I do see that we have a 10 a.m. meeting tomorrow, but we also, I have floor session tomorrow at 10:30, and also there's a meeting at 10, so we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do with that meeting also. So part of why we set Saturday aside was for the spillover, so some of those bills will go to Saturday. We'll catch up as much as we can between now and then, but we'll come in on Saturday also. So first we've got House Bill 307, Integrated Transmission Systems. We'll hear from the Department of Commerce. They're going to be doing a comparison between our bill and what might need to change from their perspective. And then we'll hear, if we've got time, we'll go to SB 67. That's the PFAS bill. If we get through that, we'll go to HB 196, food stamp eligibility. I'm thinking we probably won't get any farther than that, but if we happen to, we can take up amendments on HB 223, that's tax and royalty for certain gas, and also amendments for HB 119, which is marijuana tax, and review the fiscal notes. So we'll go ahead and start off with HB 307, that's integrated transmission systems, and I'd like to ask Mr. Andrew Jensen, policy advisor to the governor, if you could please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present after a long day that I know you've had. For the record, Andrew Jensen, policy advisor on energy and food security for Governor Dunleavy, and happy to kind of walk through just a quick presentation on HB 307, which I know you've heard and had public testimony on, and happy to answer the questions that members may have.
And really quickly, I just want to recognize that we also have with us Representative Stepp, Representative Co-Chair Johnson, and with that, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So just starting off and just kind of a quick reminder, I think most are familiar with Governor Dunleavy's energy policy priorities, and specifically as we're thinking about the rail belt, which is where the HB 307 is really geared toward. And first of all, is open access that's non-discriminatory to the source of the power generation. And so that could be renewables, that can be coal, that can be advanced nuclear. We are agnostic about the source of that power. And so, and to that point, he wants the lowest cost power to move from anywhere to anywhere without any artificial barriers. So these are the main energy policies that we're working to address through this legislation. And so how does HB 307 achieve that? So it takes on two policy matters. It eliminates what are known as wheeling rates in favor of a new transmission cost recovery mechanism that would be developed by an association of the rail belt utilities and ultimately would have to be approved by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Secondly, it creates tax parity for independent power producers by providing the same tax exemption for power generation as the tax-exempt cooperatives or a municipally-owned utility would enjoy. And then, you know, we've had a lot of public testimony on this, and I know you've heard from the utility CEOs and members of the public. So there's definitely things that have been identified that could be improved. One of the first things that was identified was fixing this double tax issue that's currently in the version of 307 regarding IPPs. And then one other thing that's been brought up is to ensure that this tax exemption only applies to future projects. We don't want to interfere with any current revenue to local governments or any pre-existing, you know, contracts that may have been agreed to. And so the double tax issue, just to familiarize on that, the way the bill is drafted would be that the IPPs would pay the same excise tax on a per kilowatt hour basis that the cooperatives pay. So that was part of the goal, to have parity. They're both exempt from the local property taxes, but they both pay the state excise tax. What was left out of the bill was that we didn't account for what happens when the utility sells that power. So you could have the independent power producer paying the excise tax, and then when the utility sells it, it's taxed a second time. And so we just want to ensure that that power is only taxed one time. And so that is definitely something that we would like to work with the committee to address. One thing that we would also think would be an improvement on it, I think that Golden Valley CEO John Burns brought this up the other day, was to include a deadline for when this cost recovery mechanism should be submitted to the RCA. I think that's just a good way to ensure accountability for the CEOs, and to ensure that the purpose of the legislation is achieved. And then I think there's also been some technical improvements to language and definitions and some clarification of responsibilities. I thought Chugach Electric's CEO Arthur Miller, I thought he made some very constructive suggestions on just, you know, improvements to the way you would define what's a transmission asset, and, you know, the responsibilities of the ERO, for example. In current statute, the ERO is responsible for creating a cost recovery standard for each utility. So what that would entail would that each utility would have to file their tariff in accordance with that standard. What HB 307 would do is the utilities would jointly file one tariff. And so I've had some folks say, well, then the ERO could just deem that acceptable because the RCA had approved it. But, you know, for clarity's sake, I think that Mr. Miller made a good point about just clarifying who's responsible for coming up with the cost recovery standard. So again, these are things that we're happy to work with the committee members on to ensure that, you know, this is the best legislation that it can be. And with that, I think that's just a good summary of kind of where we are right now, and happy to take the members' questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have questions of the committee? Okay, I don't see any. So we do have a question, Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Jensen, the second bullet of how could the bill be improved, provide for a deadline for cost recovery. Can you give me some more details of, like, a deadline that they set it up, or once the IPP is up operational and before they start selling it?
Thank you.
We're kind of into the weeds and the details here, and so I'm not disagreeing with that as a point, but need some more specificity.
Yes, thank you for the question. Through the co-chair, Representative Hannon, that provision is related to when the Association of Rail Belt Utilities would be required to submit their cost recovery mechanism to the RCA for review. I think we've heard in public testimony from the utilities that they've actually been having weekly meetings amongst themselves, including regulatory attorneys and consultants, to actually develop what this cost recovery mechanism could look like. And I believe that Mr. Burns from Golden Valley the other day said that they feel like they could have a product ready by the end of the year. And so we feel like it would be helpful to put a reasonable deadline in the bill that would say this Rail Belt Association would submit their proposal to the RCA by a certain date. And we'd be happy to work with you on maybe what that date exactly should be. But I think that if they feel like they could have something prepared by the end of the year, I think maybe sometime, you know, shortly after that would be a good look.
Follow up,
and I guess partly to you, Mr. Foster, because again, we already have a deadline for amendments, and I don't know if Mr. Jensen has worked with the committee or whoever's carrying the bill to draft some language and get it submitted for amendments, or
has anyone worked with you, Mr. Jensen, so far?
Through the chair, Representative Foster and to Representative Hannon, no, this was just sort of based on what I heard from Mr. Burns the other day, and also in terms of what we believe the committee wanted to hear today in terms of what could be done with 307. And I believe that the way the bill is written, I think it may be fairly simple to just, you know, a sentence or two that says you'll submit it by such and such date.
Okay.
Representative Hannon. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And then I guess, Mr. Jensen, the third bullet of technical improvements to language and definitions, I guess I'm looking to see with some specificity what those definitions are, because, again, we're sort of, you know, we're not doing a lot of off time, flesh this out, bounce it around. It's at the stage of request ledge legal to draft online for the definition as this, this, this. And, you know, I'm in the minority, so perhaps this has all been dealt with, but.
through the co-chair, Representative Hannon. I was also, you know, this was sort of language that came to the committee, I believe, last week. I think it was the April 25th presentation that Mr. Miller gave, and he provided some specific lines within the statute with deleting a couple sections and then adding ancillary services to it with the transmission asset. So I thought those were very sort of simple fixes that I thought, you know, could potentially be helpful if, you know, understanding your drafting process and what those what that kind of time might take. But certainly, again, in the spirit of what I was asked to kind of present on, I wanted to sort of say, here's what we've heard in public testimony from our side of things, where if there are some improvements that could be made, those were some areas that we identified.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, Mr. Jensen, I had a question on the I think it's the second slide, the governor's policy priorities. It says it's the lowest cost power move. He's looking for the lowest cost is non-discriminatory. So I am a bit discriminatory. I'm looking for the cheapest, right, and most reliable. So what part of this bill is, and do you see this bill lowering costs for ratepayers?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Klum. What we mean by that is right now, the way the transmission costs are recovered, they're recovered sort of in the wholesale portion of the transaction. And so you have a fixed cost that can be added to a variable cost. And if that fixed cost, when added to the variable cost, makes it more expensive, then that transaction may not happen. And so we believe that if you change the point of that cost recovery to the end point, the end user, like on a per kilowatt hour type of surcharge, you're still going to recover the amount of money that the utilities need to pay for the system, but you would do it at that point of the sale rather than in the middle of it at the wholesale level. Because we do know of some instances, and I think there's been some comment about when, for example, Fire Island wanted to expand and sell to Golden Valley, but when you added those transmission costs along the way, then it was no longer the lowest cost power, even though at the point of generation it may have been. So when we talk about bringing the lowest cost power, it's don't let the fixed cost get in the way of what's actually the cheapest power, because the transmission cost is going to be the same whether you're moving 10 megawatts of coal, 10 megawatts of wind, etc. Mm-hmm. So you don't want that fixed cost to get in the way of the wholesale transaction.
Follow up. So when you are talking about variable costs, are you talking about the wheeling rates?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, the variable cost would be the cost of the power generation. So there's a different cost for generating power with gas. There's a different cost for generating with coal or with wind or et cetera. So that's where you have a variability in the cost of power. But the transmission cost is generally the same. It's fixed. And so if you put that on at that point in the sale, it can actually prevent the cheapest cost power from moving.
So follow up. So the Chugach Electric, well, several utilities asked that we add into this new tariff the ancillary parts of generating power. How do you feel about that?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, I think that's a well-rooted suggestion in that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has something called the Mansfield test. And there's five distinct criteria that are generally accepted industry standards that define what's a transmission asset. And that does encompass things like ancillary services in terms of, is it necessary to actually move the power? So I think there are some industry standards. And I think that was one thing that Mr. Miller was getting at in terms of using definitions that align with industry standards.
Follow up. So if we add those, that would essentially add to the tariff. That would raise the rate if we folded those in.
Through the chair, Representative Klum, those costs are already in the cost of electricity. They're within the retail rate, but they're sort of embedded within it, and so they become part of the wholesale transaction. So the customer never really sees, like, here's actually the part of your bill that's related to transmission. So in a concept of this would be perhaps a per kilowatt hour charge that then recovers the cost of transmission rather than recovering the cost in the wholesale transaction.
Mm-hmm. So a follow-up. So all that being said, I still don't see as you even out the cost along the rail build, that's not going to lower the rates for True Gas Electric customers.
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, not immediately necessarily, mm-hmm. But what we do know is that we do need a more diverse energy supply when we have 80-something percent of the power is generated by gas and we have a shortage situation. So the utilities are really looking for other sources of power generation to reduce their reliance on the gas. And so that's where we look at things like if the wheeling tariff or the property tax gets in the way of those generation projects being developed, then we're trying to remove those barriers so that the utilities can pursue different sources of power generation because, you know, if Chugach built a wind farm by itself, they would be tax exempt for that wind farm. But if they don't have the wherewithal financially to build it themselves, they need to partner with somebody. And so, but if that entity then becomes taxed, then the economics may break down and then the project doesn't get done. So through the change in transmission, which isn't designed to take or make anybody less whole, just change how they're recovered and then smooth the way for additional power projects to come online. We think that will help offset demand for gas, which we know that the imported gas is far more expensive than other potential sources of generation that may be out there.
So one more follow-up. So you're talking about artificial barriers. Is that you're talking about the wheeling rates and the property tax? What's the artificial barriers that you're talking about?
Through the chair, yes, we would consider that if the way the transmission cost is being recovered today is creating a barrier to development, then we would say that's an artificial barrier, I guess would say, or it's unnecessary because we can still recover the costs if you just do it in a different fashion than you're taking away a barrier. And then I would certainly say that, you know, that the issue of the property taxes, because again, you're looking at the cooperative's power generation doesn't pay any taxes. So if you're trying to beat their, you know, what's called the avoided cost of them generating the power, then you're at a little bit of a disadvantage because they're not paying a property tax. And maybe when you add those property taxes in, now you can't come in below what their current price is. And so we're trying to level that playing field from a tax perspective. And that's why we narrowed it to only wholesale power, mm-hmm. sales that only go to that tax exempt. We did not allow them. So if you want to sell retail to an industrial customer, well, then you're not going to have that tax exemption.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to recognize that we're also joined by Representative Edgman. Next question to Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Throughout the testimony period that we had, both invited testimony and others from the public, we've heard kind of some mixed messages. Interestingly, from the north, we heard from Mr. Burns, we've got to do something now. Don't slow roll it, I think was the words he used. And then down to Homer, which was just the opposite. And I would say the folks out of Anchorage were right in the middle. If you're going to do something, you might need to make some tweaks. I've just found this fascinating as somebody who's not really a part of this sort of decision-making in energy very often. And so I'm kind of coming to grips with that. And I wanted to hear your thoughts about the expediency of this. And if you could give us some context around why you are in that space of getting this done in the next week, or if there is, if it's not an urgency.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we believe that, you know, it will take some time to deal with the wheeling rate issue because transmission costs are being recovered through tariffs in a certain way now, and it will take some time to unwind that. And so to the degree that, you know, an entity like Homer has some concerns about it, again, they're having weekly meetings. Ultimately, this has to go to the RCA. It's going to be a fairly lengthy process to deal with the transmission cost recovery issue. So we believe that stakeholder concerns that are out there can be addressed through that process. But what we believe and why we believe that there's some expediency that's necessary for this is for project development. Because if we can pass legislation this session that gives cost certainty to project developers, they know, well, I don't have to calculate the wheeling rate into my cost of power. I don't have to calculate the property tax into my cost of power. They can move forward in a much better fashion in terms of negotiations with utilities, partnering on projects. And, you know, Golden Valley mentioned that that they're in serious talks with two different power developers. But if the, and they need to be able to sell their excess capacity down the rail belt. So if they're going to have to account for those wheeling charges as it comes down the system, then that is going to be a barrier to getting a firm contract price with Golden Valley. So we believe that this is important to set the policy in place to allow the project developments to go forward. I think if this doesn't pass, then they're still kind of in a limbo. And, you know, if the utilities have been, again, on the record saying we've been meeting every week since November and are planning to have some, they're doing that because they anticipate this, something along these lines passing, and they're trying to be ready. And so I think it's very important that we take advantage of that, because we certainly hear a lot about the rail belt utilities and dysfunction and they don't get along and whatever. I think we're at a rare moment, I think, of real alignment when you look at the GRIP opportunity, what that's really going to do to open up and deconstrain the system, and then looking at being able to advance these projects, the fact that they're meeting every week to work on this even before legislation passes. I mean, I think that's an opportunity that we don't want to miss.
Follow up, if I may. So it seems like the GRIP is the very first piece that has to get into place. And that's with the funding that the legislature is providing, that's we can set aside. And then I guess my question is, there seems to be an alliance around the understanding that the stacking or wheeling is not going to it's not going to exist down the line. There seems to be, and I guess it's unclear to me as to whether you need to have that piece in legislation now, or is that also something that's going to be grown organically from the governor's group that has been meeting regularly? And if you could just help me understand that piece. I do appreciate what you're saying, that the IPPs and others who are putting together grants plus investors and big projects need to have a good sense of where this is heading in terms of pricing. I get that. I'm just trying to appreciate that 307 has to get done in the next week and a half so that the building blocks from there can progress.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Galvin. Yes, we do believe it is necessary to have that, what people call regulatory certainty or statutory certainty, cost certainty. If the issue of wheeling rates is still floating around out there, and yeah, they're working together and they might have something to the end of the year that they could, that's, no one's going to invest in that environment or sign firm contracts or, you know, develop a project. And then we will have essentially let a whole year go by until next session, potentially with a little bit of limbo around project development. And I think that when you see stuff that's on the table, that people are very seriously talking about, where the utilities are working to partner with, you know, Chugach is working with independent power producers, Golden Valley is, MEA has already done deals with independent power producers. So we do feel that setting this issue aside and taking advantage of the work that's being done is very important this year.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any further questions? Okay, I see none. So as was mentioned, we did set an amendment deadline. So just as a reminder, that amendment deadline is tomorrow, May 2nd at noon. I'm sorry, at 5 o'clock. Tomorrow, May 2nd at 5 o'clock. So with that, anything in closing, Mr. Jensen?
No, not really, other than just say thank you. Thank you to the members of the committee. Thank you to the chairs for the opportunity to present and share this this bill and to hear about the governor's priorities and just why we just have a really high priority on it this year. So I just want to thank you for making the time after what I know has been a long day of several long days. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next up we have Senate Bill 67. That's the PFAS bill. I'd like to ask Senator Jesse Keel as well as his staff. They might not be here yet. Oh, I see Ms. Kathy Schlinghade. I believe I'm saying your last name correct. And if you would like, we can take a brief at ease to see if the senator is on his way.
My senator.
Oh, great. All right. The man with the plan, Mr. Senator Keel. So we are going to take up public testimony for the bill. I don't think we've got very many people online, if any, at this point, but we might have some folks in the audience. And then we'll close public testimony, look at the fiscal notes, and if it is the will of a committee, we'll potentially move the bill. Anyway, Senator Keel, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. A privilege to be with you. My name is Jesse Keel, and I get to serve as the senator for Senate District B. With me is Kathy Schlingheide of my staff. Thank you for, again, hearing Senate Bill 67. The very short description of the legislation is that it is a no new spills bill for PFAS substances. These are chemical substances that combine carbon and fluorine in ways that are very, very hard to break down. They get known as forever chemicals. They are toxic to people in very, very small amounts. In Alaska, they usually they've gotten into the water almost always because of firefighting foams. Senate Bill 67 prohibits the use of firefighting foams that have PFAS in them. With very, very limited exception. There is a delayed effect, for instance, for the oil and gas industry, where there are not yet suitable alternate chemicals. The bill also requires the state to help some of our very small villages dispose of PFAS firefighting foam that, frankly, we helped put there, and that those small villages don't generally have the capacity to dispose of themselves. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to go through in as much detail as you like, but for the committee's refresher, that's the heart and soul of it.
That's great. I know this bill has been around a few times. I think we're familiar with it. I actually got ahead of myself. As much as I would like to move it ASAP, we have to set an amendment deadline, so we'll do that. But what I'd like to do maybe is go to public testimony first, and so I will open public testimony on SB 67. That's the PFAS bill. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? I believe we have one, Ms. Melanie Lesh. If you could put yourself on the record and What would the correct terminology be? I'm not declaring a conflict of interest, but in a effort to be transparent, Ms. Lesh is my front desk. So with that, Ms. Lesh, if you could put yourself on the record.
Hello. For the record, my name is Melanie Lesh, and I'm a resident of Gustavus, which is the gateway to Glacier Bay National Park. I would like to thank Senator Keel and his staff, Kathy, for their perseverance in addressing the PFAS problem in Alaska. I'd also like to thank Representative Stapp for his carrying the companion bill. We're lucky to live in this isolated and beautiful state, and it is ironic that for the past 6 years, it has not been safe for me to drink my well water. Of the many iterations of the bill, this one is a good starting point, and it's clear that we need to remove this toxic substance from our rural towns and villages. At the time I originally wrote this testimony, which I just found on my phone, which was about 4 years ago, my oncologist was concerned when I told her about the chemicals that I'd been exposed to during my 40 years of life in the pristine gateway to Glacier Bay, Gustavus. But she didn't have the means to test me then. Plus, they aren't in the business of researching the causes of cancer. But we have since been plasma tested, and my family, my neighbors, and most of the people in my vicinity downstream from the Gustavus Airport have PFAS plasma levels many times over the lifetime limits. So I would like you to please consider supporting Senate Bill 67 and get this passed and approved by the governor, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much, and I didn't realize that you could have that specific testing, so I think that's a good educational comments. And so we've got a couple folks who have questions or comments. Representative Josephson and then Galvin.
Through the chair, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lesh. I spent several days in Gustavus last summer, and so I have a good feel for it. It's quite spread out. And I'm just wondering what you know about, is it sort of a plume issue like with sulfalane, where it's not just the area around the fire department? For example, the airport is closer to the water, and Bartlett Cove is a long way away. What do you know about the spread of?
I won't go too far into it through the chair, Representative Josephson. The fire department is actually not in the groundwater plume area. I am down a groundwater plume from the airport. And in World War II, my river, which I'm on a riverbank, was the nearest water delivery for the construction work to build the Gustavus Airport. So it has been the channel, the natural channel for the PFAS chemicals to just flow right past my neighbors and me, whereas the fire department is on the other side of the river and not affected.
Follow up.
So what you're reporting is many decades old problem, and more than the fire department in this instance.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Yes, but it's all the exposure to PFAS, the AFFF, the aqueous film forming foam, has been exposed and released by the fire department because of our airport.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Galvin.
And thank you through the chair. Thank you for your testimony. And I'm curious to know, I think you mentioned your well water. So I presume then it went down and into that particular underground river or well that feeds your well. Is it also something that is a problem for those who garden or, you know, those who maybe, I'm trying to learn a bit more about the soils. I know in Anchorage there's some issues in Sand Lake, for example, with their soil. And I don't know if that's the case with Gustavus as well. And I just thought I'd see if you have any info on that.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, and also thank you for your WEP legislation, which passed today. Yes, the saturation is in my well, and so I have received a cistern as part of a settlement and a kind of a release of liability to the state or from the state. So I can't drink my well water. I drink my rainwater, and my gardening, I don't water. Thankfully, it's raining down in Southeast.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hennen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Lesh. The first 4 years that I was in office, I represented Gustavus. And, you know, one of the sayings that we have as lawmakers is it's an opportunity for lifelong learning. PFAS was something I knew nothing about till I got elected and met you and your, well, I already knew you. The citizens of Gustavus who had activated around the pollution there. And Gustavus happens to be a community that's full of scientists. It has a really high level of PhDs. People are drawn there with the National Park Service, decided to build a beautiful life. Most of them have extensive gardens, and they have chickens. And there is no community water system. Everyone has cistern or well. Almost everybody has a huge garden. Almost everybody. It's one of the places in Southeast where you can harvest moose. Gustavus, as a community with activists there, have been on the front end of trying to educate Alaska and trying to test the game meat that's there, do plasma testing before they were sort of even as accepted levels of testing. We have a lot of work to do to protect Alaskans. What we do know is the longitudinal health of many Alaskans has been harmed
significantly by PFAS exposure. And now, you know that saying, now that we know better, we need to do better. So we need to prevent it from going forward and more pollution plumes, and we need to clean up where it is. Most of the people who in Gustavus have not been able to harvest from their gardens, if they are concerned about the PFAS level, eat the eggs their chickens produce because they're picking enough up from the soil. And I know that Greg Strebler was working on doing some meat testing to see what the PFAS level in moose harvested out there was. And that's the kind of level of engagement that those citizens bring. And when you, as a representative, try and craft a law to correct a harm that's been done, and it's been done extensively to many communities or neighborhoods of communities across Alaska, it's kind of hard to fathom. Yet Ms. Lesh manages to have a smile on her face and welcome her boss every day to work. And so thank you for coming here and sharing. I know what is a really painful sort of history of where everyone in Gustavus is with this issue, because living on a pollution plume does not make you feel so comfortable in your own home.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for Ms. Lesh? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online who would like to testify? I don't see anybody. So with that, again, if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that, I will close public testimony on SB 67, PFAS bill. And that will take us over to the fiscal notes. We have two. The first is with the DOT. Mr. Andy Mills, I believe you're on line. Mr. Mills, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Andy Mills, Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. For the committee, we have a fiscal note that I'm now reviewing. Apologize that a little bit of the information in the analysis is part of last year, but the fiscal information and much of the analysis is still, of course, relevant to the bill that's before you. For the fiscal note itself, primarily in the analysis, we would point out that we did get some research fairly extensively that revealed the number of Project Code Red sites across the state, which allowed us to ping some environmental contractors to get rough estimates of what the disposal costs would look like for DOT to do contracted services. The fiscal note speaks to one position to coordinate that disposal program, and an estimated capital cost, as you can see in the fiscal note, of 2.5. That was an average of two contractor estimates that gets us as close as we believe we can at a reasonable cost for disposal of these known sites that had a Project Code Red AFFF substance to dispose of. I'm certainly willing to take any additional questions on this fiscal note if there are any.
Okay, thank you. And that's for OMB component number 2355. Do you have any questions of the committee? I don't see any. So thank you very much, Mr. Mills. Next, we'll move over to Ms. Lisa Purinton, who's in the room. Ms. Purinton, if you can put yourself on the record and walk us through the other fiscal note. Looks like that one is OMB component 3051.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Lisa Purinton, Acting Legislative Liaison with the Department of Public Safety. As you mentioned, this is for our fiscal note is for OMB component 3051 for the Division of Fire and Life Safety. The department is submitting a zero fiscal note. At this time, we're not anticipating a significant fiscal impact from this bill.
Thank you. Do we have any questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Purinton. I am going to deviate from my paperwork here, and I'll look at my staff and see what his reaction is. Does anybody think they might be doing an amendment? And if you think you need time for any amendments, more than happy to set it. If you don't think you're going to do an amendment, I'll take a brief at ease. And I'm not seeing any interest in doing an amendment, so I'm going to take a brief at ease. And brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 6:22 p.m., and we are taking up one amendment for the PFAS bill, which is SB 67, and we have an amendment from Representative Stapp. Representative Stapp, would you like to move your amendments?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move Amendment 1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So Amendment 1 makes some structural changes to the disposal reimbursement requirements. The sponsor of the bill, I carried the companion of the House, Senator Keel, and I worked quite a bit during the interim and, of course, throughout the session to find language that best fit the concerns that the DEC had. And I would be happy to bring the senator back up to the committee room to speak to the amendment, Mr. Co-Chair Foster. And, of course, I know that we have Ms. Kinnaman, too, from DEC as well to discuss fiscal note potential impact.
Okay, and Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Jesse Keel, Senate District B. The amendment before you reflects a lot of work by DEC, Department of Public Safety, with Department of Law. It builds on the good work that Department of Transportation did last year to build the fiscal note that you just went over. This approach, as the amendment sponsor told you, shifts from the state of Alaska taking the PFAS foam from small rural villages to a reimbursement program. That is the fundamental change in front of you. It is still limited to the same group of small rural villages who got the PFAS through a partially state-funded program. And here I'm referring to the Project Code Red carts from about a decade ago, a little more than a decade ago. The department will be able to talk. I believe it's roughly the same amount of money. Those villages will be able to dispose of the PFAS foams, the concentrates, and get reimbursed through this the mechanism in this amendment. Mr. Chairman, that helps the Department of Law with some concerns they had about potential liability. Most importantly, it still gets the job done. So this is an effective amendment, and I appreciate Representative Stapp bringing it to the committee. May I, Mr. Chairman, ask my staff to fill in a couple of gaps that I fear I've left?
Absolutely. Ms. Schlinghide, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Kathy Schlinghide, staff to Senator Keel. There are two other small changes in the amendment. One was brought to us by folks in industry that has a lot of server rooms, like telecom companies. They use clean agent firefighting agents, which are gases that take the oxygen out of the room. Some of those halon replacements are now in other states being classified as PFAS, and we wanted to be really clear that this bill is not about those clean firefighting agents. There are not currently replacements for them. This is about the firefighting foam that we've been talking about. So in the provisions that ban the use of the foam, it clarifies it's foam, not substance, for that purpose. It also updates the effective date by 1 year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And if I could first get Ms. Crystal Kinnaman to just put yourself on the record and let us know what you think of this, and then we'll go to questions, and that might have been the question. Okay, Ms. Kinnaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Crystal Kinnaman, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Both of the sponsors of the House bill as well as Senate Bill 67 that you have before us, they've worked very closely with us on this language. We feel comfortable with the language that is presented, and we have no concerns at this time.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions of the committee? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. through the chair, my question could be for the amendment sponsor or for the prime sponsor of the bill. With this particular amendment, you describe it as the removal process of the asbestos will come from the village workforce rather than from the state. Am I correct in that, first of all?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Representative Ortiz's question, the PFAS removal in this case, well, I suppose it could be done by a village employee. The analysis that we've done envisions a contractor coming in with the appropriate training to handle these hazardous substances.
That clarifies things. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have any other questions What I'll do is I'll remove my objection on amendment number one, and then we'll have Ms. Kinnaman walk us through the new fiscal note for DEC after we've gotten through the amendments. And I think we'll be good. So unless there's anything else that needs to be spoken to regarding this amendment, I will remove my objection to amendment number one. And hearing no other objections, amendment number one has been adopted. And Ms. Kinnaman, can you walk us through the new fiscal note, which is OMB component 3094?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, Crystal Kinnaman, legislative liaison. The fiscal note you have before you, I do want to point out it's in draft form. Just want to verify that nothing else had changed prior to releasing this note and getting it uploaded prior to this. But we do not anticipate any operating costs associated with this. While the previous DOT fiscal note had anticipated personnel costs, because this program would be, the communities would be contracting with a third-party contractor, they would then submit said reimbursements to the department, which is part of our standard operating of what we do. So depending on the amount and the workload, we believe we can absorb those costs. We did maintain the $2.5 million capital expenditure in order to have that pot of money available for those communities to reimburse based on contractor costs as well as the amount of the Trimax carts that we believe are still out there, and then the other tiers within the reimbursement. We believe that that $2.5 million can cover that. We do believe and are under the understanding that this $2.5 million would be UGF funding. We do not have the funds within DEC to take on those capital costs, as well as the oil has fund has specific statutory purposes around that. And just wanted to make sure that was clear what our expectations were.
Okay. We don't have any questions as far as I can see. So with that, we just need to have a motion sheet brought up here, and I think that is ready. Just going to give everyone an opportunity just in case you've got any more questions. And I will take a very brief at ease while we get the motion sheet up here. House Finance, back on record at 6:30 p.m. Ms. Kinnaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the other things that I wanted to note, thank you, Representative Hannon, during that, Eddie's, this fiscal note for DEC does replace the DOT fiscal note, so there would not be two fiscal notes for that 2.5 capital appropriation, just this one.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, well, I would, Senator Keel, let's just go to the motion. Representative Edgman, entertain a motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move Senate Bill 6733-LS00148/S.9 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, and that the legislative legal services be given permission to make technical and conforming changes.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no objection, SB 67, which is 33-LS0148/S.9, moves as amended from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And we also give Ledge Legal permission to make technical and conforming changes. If folks could please sign the committee report, I would like to give Senator Keel any last closing comments.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, So with that, we will now move over to House Bill 196. That's the food stamp program eligibility. And I'd like to ask Representative Mina and her staff, Ms. Katie Giorgio, to please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and introduce the bill. This is the first hearing on this bill, whereas with the PFAS bill, we had heard it at least once before. As much as I'm tempted to just move it, we should at least hear it and then set the amendment deadline. So with that, also online, we have for questions and public testimony, Juan Meehan, Director of Government Affairs for the Food Bank of Alaska. So with that, thank you very much, Ms. Mina, for being here.
Thank you, Chair Fosters and esteemed members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, Genevieve Mina, House District 19 Representative, and I'm also here with my staff, Katie Giorgio. Thank you for hearing House Bill 196, a bill to improve Alaska's SNAP program by allowing the Department of Health to enact broad-based categorical eligibility. I'll explain that later in my presentation. I know this committee has had extensive hearings on SNAP and its backlogs, and I want to first commend the effort and the leadership of the Division of Public Assistance, DOH, and the administration to communicate with the legislature on the backlog, but also on different policy recommendations and ways that we can improve the SNAP program altogether. SNAP is Alaska's largest and strongest food security program. It is 100% funded by the federal government, and it also includes work requirements for able-bodied adults, as well as a step-down approach where if you earn more in your income, you receive less in your SNAP benefits. States follow federal rules to administer that program, but there is some flexibility in how that program is administered. We know that with the backlog, when the state failed to deliver SNAP, constituents go hungry and they rely on food pantries oftentimes, and people go hungry, and we don't want that to happen. This does strain our food security system in the state, and it also costs the state when we purchase bulk food programs using state general funds. During these hearings on the backlog, one of the policies that was proposed and talked about from the Division of Public Assistance was called Broad-Based Categorical Eligibility, otherwise known as BBCE. Currently, Alaska's SNAP requirements are based off of the federal guidelines, which is 130% the federal poverty standard. In Alaska, it's 130% the Alaska poverty level, and this is the gross income. There is also a requirement to have an asset limit. And the issues with following the federal standards are twofold. First, let's talk about the income limit. The current income limit has a steep benefits cliff at 130% poverty level that discourages working families from earning more. How does this happen? Well, if you are a low-income household and you have high expenses, perhaps due to childcare, utilities, energy costs, that means that there is less money left over for food for your family. And so if you are a family deciding to undergo SNAP, you receive a larger SNAP benefit. But if you're a single parent with two kids, you're 125% of the poverty level, and you take a modest raise, that can be a situation where you could lose more in your SNAP benefits than you would gain in your raise, discouraging many households from earning more and mitigating against the point of SNAP, which is to help with food security and encourage self-sufficiency for Alaskans. Twofold, on the other hand, the asset limit is too restricted. Currently in Alaska, it's $2,750. And if you have a household that has at least an elderly individual or someone with a disability, it's $4,250. Because of the restrictive nature of the asset limit, and the assets can also apply to owning a second vehicle, or perhaps owning a snow machine, a four-wheeler, and a boat, it prevents a lot of Alaskans who may not have income from being on the SNAP program. It prevents individuals and low-income people from having savings, which is a pathway out of poverty. It forces many low-income seniors to spend down their assets that they've worked really hard to save for. And it's also bureaucratic for the Division of Public Administration to administer in terms of checking the assets of every single person that applies for SNAP. What does BBCE do?
This is a federal flexibility that's been enacted in 42 states and two territories. So we are in the small minority of states that hasn't applied this flexibility. And it means that if you are a person that is eligible for TANF, which is temporary in need of aid, the program, you are also categorically eligible for SNAP. So what would this actually do? It would allow the Department of Health to raise the income limit for SNAP from 130% poverty level to 200% poverty level, and would also allow the Department of Health to waive the asset test. Impacts of this policy includes reducing the steep nature of the benefits cliff and encouraging more families to be able to take a raise or to be able to take another job and earn more and support their families. It allows more people to save, which is a way out of poverty. It simplifies SNAP administration, saving more time and money for the state. And it also supports local economies because SNAP is an economic driver in many communities. No Alaskan should go hungry. House Bill 196 helps Alaskans be more self-sufficient, and it helps our government be more efficient.
Okay, thank you very much. We've got a question, Representative Stapp.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Mina. I'm going to have actually a few here. So, Representative, I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I have lots of concerns about the bill. My first question to you through the chair is, how many SNAP applications did the Department of Public Assistance have to process last year? Not including backlog, do we know?
Thank you for the question, Rep. Staff, through the chair. I don't have that question at hand, but I'm happy to defer that to the director of DPA.
Ms. Etheridge, are you there? And if you are, if you could put yourself on the record or in the room. Thanks for being here.
For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance. We have approximately over 60,000 individuals on our SNAP program right now, with an average size of average number of people on each case is 2 or 2.5.
Yeah, thank you, follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair, to Director Etheridge. So if we go from 130% to 200% of the poverty line, how many more eligible Alaskans does that make DPA look at processing in terms of SNAP?
Through the chair, Representative, estimating the increase in the number of SNAP applicants or cases is difficult. It assumes that individuals would apply, and it also assumes I have insight into who's living at that level.
Yeah, follow up to the Mr. Kutcher.
Follow up.
Yeah, the reason I asked the question is obviously we just had a big SNAP backlog. So it's a 70% jump in poverty line. So through the chair to Director Etheridge, we could probably get that data, could we not? I mean, we could make our best educated guess based on how many additional Alaskans would be qualifying for the program and then what the persistency level of that if we were to past broad-based category would be, don't you think?
Through the chair, Representative, we could potentially make an educated guess at what that is. We've tried to sort of come up with that number, and it's been a little complicated.
And, another fault, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, through the chair to Director Etheridge. Again, the reason I ask is because we went through about almost a two-year nightmare on a staff backlog. So if we were to look at dramatically increasing the amount of individuals that we were put on the program, even with the sunset date, I know it's the effective date of next fiscal year in FY25, my thought would be, what is the existing processing time of SNAP applications per applications director, and what do you think the changed processing time, if we were to enact this bill, would be through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I think what's important to note is the effective date. The effective date of this bill aligns with our milestones in making some changes. Currently, the SNAP program is operated out of our eligibility information system, which is our legacy information system. And the intention is to move to a modular, more agile system that allows more robotic automated processing. And so we do anticipate to find efficiencies very similar to the efficiencies that we're finding in our ARIES program for Medicaid.
Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair? I'll simplify the question through the chair to Director Etheridge. Okay, so you are moving these modules in any ways in 25. If we were to enact this and expand eligibility for SNAP up to 200% of poverty line, will it be more cumbersome or less cumbersome in terms of time for the department to process and volume, more or less? What do we think?
Through the chair, we anticipate that it's about the same amount of time to process or potentially less as we see efficiencies with technology.
And through the chair to Director Etheridge, too. So to clarify, the efficiencies are the technology. They're not the change in the application. Or do you anticipate a dramatic decrease in the amount of processing time if this bill were to be enacted?
Through the chair, thank you for that question, because we do anticipate a more ease in eligibility because of not having to verify assets.
And I have one last one for the bill sponsor, Mr. Kocher. Yeah, through the chair to Representative Mina, or staff, you mentioned asset limits. What are the current asset limits required? You know what the current number is for recipients of SNAP in the state of Alaska, through the chair?
Thank you, Rep. Stapp. Through the chair, I believe the current asset limits are $2,750 and then $4,250 if there's a household where there is an elderly individual or a disabled individual, but I'm also happy to have that fact checked by Director Etheridge.
Through the chair, what does asset mean? Is that just cash, or is that, you mentioned snow machine, through the chair? I mean, are we talking like all your assets, or are we talking about stocks, or is it just?
Thank you for the chair, Rep. Stapp, through the chair. So assets will mean your savings, other property that you have. If you own more than one vehicle, that would count as an asset. If Director Etheridge also has information on assets.
Director Etheridge?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative. Other is assets is you could have other property or, like you said, a secondary vehicle. And so that would be considered an asset or a savings account.
Okay, before we go to questions, we have just four people online for public testimony, so I'd like to make sure we give them time, just in case we time out, which I think we can probably go till 7:10, so that gives us about 25 minutes. So with that, I am going to open public testimony on HB 196. That is the food stamp program eligibility bill. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. So first up, we've got Jamie Morgan calling in from Sacramento, California. Jamie, if you can put yourself on the record, just state your name and your affiliation. Proceed with your three-minute testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jamie Morgan. I am the Senior Region Lead of State Government Relations for the American Heart Association, and happy to be calling in strong support of HB 196. Implementing broad-based categorical eligibility will provide targeted assistance for low-income working families and seniors. Raising the gross income limit primarily benefits working families with children, as they are more likely to have competing expenses like childcare, housing, and utilities, leaving them unable to afford the necessary foods for a healthy diet, which is critical for preventing heart disease and stroke. Removing the asset test also helps households, often seniors, with modest savings or assets still qualify for the assistance they need while reducing the administrative burden on the state. States that have adopted SNAP supportive policies like broad-based categorical eligibility generally have more SNAP eligible participation than do states without these policies. Policies that make SNAP easier to access increase participation in the program, food insecurity is reduced, and fewer children and families go hungry. This legislation comes at a time that food insecurity levels are already elevated, and SNAP is a crucial program that helps Alaska's anti-hunger network meet the need. It's for these reasons American Heart Association supports HB 196 to reduce hunger in Alaska, eliminate administrative burdens on DPA, and save the state money. We urge you to support this bill, and thank you for your time this evening.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Morgan. I don't see any questions to the committee, so we'll next move over to Dean Humphreys calling in from Anchorage. If you can state your name, your affiliation, proceed with your three-minute testimony.
My name name is Dean Humphreys. I work with Lutheran Social Services of Alaska. I'm the director of operations for one of the largest food pantries in the state. So I'm on this call to express my strong support for House Bill 196, which aims to simplify the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program process in Alaska. I believe that this bill will have a positive impact on our community by expanding access to SNAP benefits for working low-income Alaskans while reducing administrative burdens. House Bill 196 introduced broad-based category eligibility, a policy that streamlines the SNAP application process. The asset test, in a way, serves as a mechanism to keep those already struggling in a cycle of poverty. By eliminating the asset test, struggling Alaskans will not have to face a benefits cliff. When Alaskans need food assistance, they turn to us. We know they're struggling. Food pantries are supposed to be the stepping stone, not the backbone. With the implementation of the food waste movement into the supply chain organization, along with many others in Alaska, I've seen a historic decline in corporate donations. LSSA serves on an average 2,300 individuals a month. When those donations disappear, less food is given to struggling Alaskans. LSSA understands the importance of ensuring that the most vulnerable populations have access to nutritious food. House Bill 196 takes a step in the right direction by making the SNAP program more efficient and effective. I urge you to continue supporting this bill and advocate for its passage. With the Senate and the House members' support, we can eliminate the cycle of poverty. We are one of nine states that still have not adopted the BBCE. Let's not be the last. Thank you for your dedication to improving the lives of Alaskans. I appreciate your efforts in addressing critical issues related to food security and public assistance. Every vulnerable Alaskan is counted on you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humphreys. I don't see any questions of the committee. We'll jump over to Hannah Hill, calling in from Fairbanks. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hello, my name is Hannah Hill, and I am the executive director of the Breadline, which is an anti-hunger organization here in Fairbanks. I'd like to thank the chairs and the members of the House Finance Committee for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm testifying to express our strong support for House Bill 196, adopting broad-based categorical eligibility for Alaska's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. When impoverished Alaskans do not receive food stamps, as we have seen in the rolling SNAP backlogs, they're forced to turn to food banks and pantries and soup kitchens like the Breadline. For the past 17 months, beginning with the SNAP backlog, every month at our soup kitchen has been a record breaker. Last month was the busiest we've ever been in the Breadline's 40-year history of feeding hungry Alaskans. Food relief organizations in every district across Alaska currently are fighting elevated community hunger, but that is significantly compounded by a decline in both local donations and the federal commodity programs. We're serving more food, more often, to more people, and we are struggling to sustain this level of service. Broad-based categorical eligibility will help protect Alaskans from hunger while they pave a path towards economic and food security. It's targeted assistance, and it focuses on low-income working families and seniors, and this will help protect vulnerable Alaskan households from further facing preventable hunger. By raising the gross income limit from 130 to 200% of the federal poverty guideline, that primarily benefits working families with children. Removing the asset test will help Alaskans, often seniors, retain modest savings while remaining qualified for food assistance that they need. There are so many benefits to adopting broad-based categorical eligibility into our state SNAP processes. Alaska can take better care of Alaskans by joining the majority of other United States in adopting this practice here. House Bill 196 has the Breadline's full support, reducing hunger in Alaska, eliminating administrative burdens on the division of public assistance, and saving the state money is in everyone's best interest. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important piece of legislation. I also want to thank the representative who put this bill forward, and I certainly hope that it moves on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. I don't see any questions from the committee, so we're going to go to our last testifier, and that's Mr. Ron Meehan calling in from Anchorage. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. For the record, my name is Ron Meehan. I am the Director of Government Affairs for the Food Bank of Alaska and the manager of the Alaska Food Coalition. The Alaska Food Coalition represents more than 180 food banks, food pantries, tribal organizations, health centers, faith-based groups, and more across the state. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 196 to implement broad-based categorical eligibility which will increase government efficiency, reduce the time necessary to process SNAP applications, and provide economic security to hardworking Alaskans. SNAP is the most effective food assistance program in the United States and helps more than 92,000 Alaskans put food on the table. That's around 1 in 8. The program also stimulates the economy, particularly for local businesses in rural areas. As Representative Mina said, SNAP is a federal program administered by the state. The benefits are 100% federally funded, and administrative costs are a 50-50 state and federal split. States have a lot of latitude in how the program is administered. Implementing BBCE will allow Alaska to eliminate the asset test and raise the income limit for certain households. Alaska uses currently the federal baseline for assets, which is $2,750 for most households. Households with at least one elderly or disabled family member cannot have assets, including money in the bank, over $4,250. This doesn't allow for meaningful savings or emergency funds, and ultimately, if an individual has $5,000 in the bank for a car or a rental deposit, they would be denied benefits under the asset test. However, they could spend that money down and potentially qualify. The state shouldn't punish hardworking Alaskans for becoming more economically independent. Seniors may work their entire lives in order to own their home, but would need to sell it and spend through their savings in order to access needed food assistance. We know many households in Alaska depend on their fishing boats, ATVs, or equipment for subsistence or hunting. These all count as assets, and Alaskans are disqualified from SNAP for having them. Ultimately, we want people to become more self-sufficient, but they can't if they aren't able to save and get off the program. Without BBCE, SNAP recipients may be offered a small raise at their job, but turn it down as it could put them over the limit to be eligible for SNAP. They could lose their benefits and end up worse off with the raise. Many are unable to work a second job for the same reason. The way SNAP eligibility is currently structured disincentivizes work. In eliminating this benefits cliff, BBCE transitions people off benefits and incentivizes them to work. BBCE also allows the state to eliminate the asset test. Assets are notoriously time-consuming, error-prone, and difficult to verify. And without the asset test, the state will cut down on the administrative time needed to work a case, thereby saving money and allowing the division to process applications faster. Over the impending SNAP backlog of the last year, we've seen directly what happens when SNAP doesn't work, as several of the other testifiers have pointed out. Food pantries and shelters continue to see, or had continued to see, really incredibly high record levels of use. The state's already been overburdened and overworked. We've seen that with these backlogs of SNAP and Medicaid applications over the last year and a half. Eliminating unnecessary verifications will increase efficiencies in processing applications, reduce the likelihood of another backlog, and make the program work better. The 42 states and 2 U.S. territories already effectively utilizing BBCE have proven that this policy helps people get out of poverty by allowing them to save and get off the program. Kentucky is an example of a state that fairly recently implemented BBCE and saw a reduction both in workload and in cost. Raising the income limit and removing the asset test will allow SNAP participants to climb their way to financial security by giving them the ability to accept pay raises and set aside savings for the future. Iowa is the only recent state that has moved away from this national trend that we're seeing. Their legislature required the state to implement the asset test last year. The Iowa Fiscal Note estimated that it would take their state agency an additional 28 minutes per case to verify assets.
Mr.
Their
Mahan?
Caseload was about 135,000 households at the time. Their fiscal note identified that they would need to hire about 47 new eligibility technicians at a cost of nearly $3 million a year to implement the asset tax.
Mr. Meehan?
It is expensive to not implement BBCE. Yes.
If you could please wrap up.
Excellent. My apologies. More than 66% of SNAP participants in Alaska are in families with children, and more than 30% are in households with at least one individual who is a senior or disabled. I strongly encourage the committee to move this bill forward. I'm happy to take any questions or to provide any follow-up needed with members of the committee.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you. If anyone would like to submit written testimony, they can email us at house.finance@aklg.gov. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Anyone online who would like to testify? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on HB 196, which is food stamp program eligibility. And so with that, we'll continue on with questions. And so in the queue, I've got Representative Galvin, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin.
I think actually a lot of the questions I had were answered in the testimony. So I'll just have one statement to make. Thank you. I think that appreciating the nuances of what's yet to come with the department being able to be more efficient. Thank you to the department for all of that work, by the way. We've struggled for over a year, as you know, trying to get to that. And so really appreciate their willingness to take on this challenge and their understanding that the assets test is going to be allowing them the more time needed or more time needed for other things and to get to more, it sounds like more applicants that may be happening because of this. I really appreciate how this is going to help our rural communities, especially thinking about also the families who really want to choose the food that they consume. I think that builds a lot of pride. And when having participated in a lot of these handouts from the food bank, I just so much appreciate how healthy the food is when families can choose their food in the market. So thank you very much.
Okay, in the queue, I've got Representative Hannon, Colomb, Conk, and Stapp. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. My question was addressed by Mr. Meehan, but I guess I'm going to just say it on the record that and affirm that 100% of the benefits are paid directly by the feds, and they'll pay half of the operating overhead administrative costs. So adding together our fiscal notes, for $138,000, we can feed more Alaskans, reduce time for evaluating each case, and hopefully help people grow out of poverty. So,
thank you. And next we've got Representative Cologne.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, two questions. One is, can you give me an idea of the income limits, 130% to 200 of Alaska poverty standard? I'm not sure what the poverty standard is. Can you give me an idea of what the income, what income are we talking about from 130 to 200?
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Foster, and thank you for the question, Rep. Colomb, through the Chair. So this is the Alaska SNAP standards effective October 1st, 2023. So the gross limit monthly would be $1,973, and then a lot of these limits also change depending on your household size.
So was that the 130% or the 200%?
Through the Chair, to Rep. Colomb, that is the 130%.
Okay.
Of the Alaska poverty standard. Everybody else does the federal poverty standard.
Okay, so we're about 2,000 a month is what's happening now. So what is the bill proposes to up to 200? Do you have an idea of what that bumps it up to? If you're just looking at an individual, I know it varies.
At ease.
Brief at ease. House Finance, background record at 7:01 p.m. And Ms. Mina and Ms. Etheridge, if we could also get a copy of the chart, too, once you're done reviewing it. But go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Foster. And to Rep. Colomb, pregnant women receive up to or are eligible up to 200% of the poverty level. And so for a household size of one, two, at ease.
And actually, Ms. Etheridge, you might be able to walk us through that.
Sorry.
For the record, my name is Deb Etheridge. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance, and the chart that's available and I provided is around pregnant women, and so actually it doesn't give a household of one. So if I could start at a household of two, I apologize for that, and I can follow up with the committee to provide that additional information. But a household of two at the 200% of FPL is 4,107. If you were to look at a household of one at the 177% of FPL, just to sort of give you a range, it's 2,686. And I can provide that information to the committee.
That'd be great. Thanks. Any follow-up, Representative Colon?
Just to clarify, so the 4,000, you're saying it's 4,107 a month?
Through the chair, Representative, correct.
Okay. Yeah, I did have one other follow-up.
Representative Colon?
So I guess I need some... It might be for you. I'm not sure who can answer this, but sorry, I'm not familiar with the asset piece of this. Can you tell me how does that affect someone's eligibility? How does that, so if you're listing your assets, like is there a certain amount of assets they can have? Does it adjust whether they're eligible or how much they're eligible? Can you kind of speak to that?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, the asset limit means that if you were to have over that asset limit, you would be ineligible for benefit.
And
income.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Foster. And through the chair to Rep. Colom, just to add more specifics on the assets under the DPA requirements. So those countable assets include cash on hand, money in checking or savings accounts, certificates of deposit, U.S. savings bonds, stocks, bonds, property not up for sale, crowdfunding accounts, and lump sum payments.
Okay. And one follow-up. So what's the limit then? What is the asset limit right now? How much makes them ineligible? You may know.
Through the chair, too, Rep. Colon, the asset limit is $2,750. And so that would include all of your assets, your savings, other property, et cetera. And if you have a household that has at least one member who is elderly or has a disability, it's $4,250.
Okay. And just to clarify, your bill is proposing to have no limit at all on assets.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Hey, Representative Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Some of my questions were answered. So I guess I'm going to ask, so what exactly is the SNAP benefit? Okay, so they qualify. What do they get?
Ms. Etheridge?
Through the chair, Representative Cronk, the SNAP benefit is a they receive what's called an electronic benefit. It's an EBT card, and the rules around what they can spend and purchase with that EBT card is set. So if you were, you can't buy things like paper towels. It's really directed to food. And so that SNAP benefit that's on that EBT card, they can use it at farmers market, they can use it at grocery stores, and in rural areas, they can also use it to purchase items for subsistence, fishing or...
Oh.
I'm just trying to grasp this. So let's say, I'm just going to go back to the 130% limit for two people. How much would be on that card then? How much would they be eligible for?
Oh, I had it right here. through the chair, Representative, we have different standards based on where you live. So we have a urban, a rural one, and a rural two standard. And I'm going to tell you the maximum and minimum. So for a household of one in urban, it's $374. And the minimum would be $30. In the rural one, it's $477. And the minimum is $38. And in the rural two, it's $588 with a minimum of $46. And these standards are set by the Federal Nutrition Services through a thrifty food plan.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Mm-hmm. Follow-up?
So we have the SNAP, but then we have food pantries. Now, okay, so is that totally a separate thing?
Through the chair, representative, yes, it's totally assumed.
Okay, follow up. Thank you. I appreciate especially the asset part because especially in rural Alaska, you know, and I guess if I wasn't doing this job, I would actually fall under your SNAP benefits. I would qualify, but my assets of my ATV or my boat that I use to go get food would disqualify from you. So thank you.
Okay. We do have to adjourn in about 3 minutes, so we'll let Representative Stapp start off. We might have to cut it short.
Yeah, I'll be super, super quick, Mr. Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to either Director Etheridge or Representative Mina. I have 5 people in my family. What would my income limit be at 200% of poverty line to qualify for SNAP in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, it would be
$7,322. On an annual basis, through the chair, you know how much that is?
I just want to clarify just for the record. Oh. So we've got we have so many familiar sounding voices.
Yes, that was Representative
Etheridge.
For the record, yeah, this is Deb Etheridge, through the chair, Representative Stapp.
And Representative Stapp?
Yeah, through the chair, to Director Etheridge, you know what that is on an annual basis?
So through the chair to Rep. Stapp, so that would be $87,864. I also want to note that with SNAP benefits, it calculates your expenses, and this is one aspect that I really want to highlight in terms of PPCE. If you have a household where you have high costs, such as childcare, utilities, et cetera, that also is calculated in the amount of SNAP benefits that you receive.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Just for the record, that was Representative Mina.
Yeah.
Representative Stapp.
Is that AGI, is that adjusted gross, or is that gross income, that $87,000 through the chair?
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Rep. Stapp, through the chair. I'm not quite sure, but I can follow up on that.
Okay. And I will, I'm sure we'll bring this bill up again, Mr. Co-Chair, so I'll just leave it at that for the sake of time.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, any I guess departing comments before we shut down for the day here, Representative Mina?
Yes, just a brief comment, just related to the administrative trade-off of raising the income limit and waiving the asset test. I just want to point out, and we can send this to the committee. There's a 2019 Congressional Budget Office report that states that the national cost of SNAP, 5% of those costs is BBCE, and so we would expect that there would be a nominal increase in applications to the state. But also, error rates are a big part of SNAP administration, and Alaska had the worst error rates last year. BBCE helps in reducing error rates.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so things are getting a little chaotic. We will go ahead and adjourn for the day. I will also be setting an amendment deadline for House Bill 115, which is the Naturopaths Bill. And that deadline will be Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. And if you can have your amendments delivered either to my staff, Brody Anderson, or Helen Phillips, our finance clerk. So our next, we were supposed to take up HB 223, which is tax and royalty for certain gas. We had 15, I believe, amendments for that, and then also HB 119, which is marijuana tax, and I believe we've had 4 amendments for that, and we're going to have to figure out where we're going to move those to. I would have liked to have taken them up at our morning meeting, the 10 a.m. meeting that was scheduled. However, some other meetings have been, we've got floor at 10:30 and another meeting at 10, so we won't be able to start at 10. The option was to move that meeting up. However, we've got some other logistical / scheduling issues, so we won't be moving that up. So we will let folks know what we intend to do, but we only had 2 bills to take up tomorrow morning, and that was Senate Bill 75, which is Audio and Speech Language Interstate Compact, and also Senate Bill 74, Physical Therapy Licensure Compact. So looks like we'll be behind by 4 bills, the 2 that we're supposed to take up today and 2 in the morning. So we'll be pushing those back. And I don't think I'm forgetting anything. I think I'm good. So with that, if there's nothing else to come for the committee, Representative Josephson.
Just to clarify, at this meeting this evening, you've calendared for amendment deadlines, House Bill 307, the transmission bill, May 2nd, 5 p.m., that's tomorrow, and the naturopath bill, May 7th, 5 p.m. Do I have that right?
Correct. Next Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. for naturopaths. And then I believe the 307 deadline was correct. So I'm looking at my staff, and that looks like that was correct. So if there is nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 7:12 p.m. Thank you.